All right. Continuing on with our discussion about ISA, infrasternal angle, we're going to talk about how to identify it, how to measure for it, and then what to do once you know which you are. A lot of times people are thrown off by measurements, or they're thrown off by visual representations, yeah, or they're thrown off by their own perception or what someone has told them. So we should try to offer people some more, not necessarily definitive, but some more reasonable and logical ways to determine for themselves and others. Mm. Yeah. What structural archetype they might be, or what their clients or patients might be. And then on top of that, what to do about it. Cause I believe there's a lot of confusion there. So all of that and more on today's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
So you got to do this again because it's going to be two episodes. I may or may not be wearing the same shirt.
Well,
so it's almost like, it's almost like we, that. Yeah, because you wear the same.
I wear the same thing every day.
So. We discussed narrow and wides. We discussed what this whole ISA thing is. We've clarified a couple things about what it means. Now we're going to talk about, a lot of people get confused about what structural archetype they are. They've been measured as this, or they were told that they were this, or they're not sure. They think that they're kind of wide, and one side is wide and one side is narrow, and all of these different confusing things. So let's try to offer some clarity to everyone that's interested in this about what helps us determine if you're wide or narrow from a measurement perspective, with actual table measures that someone might be able to give you, with visual assessments, with how you move through certain dynamic activities. And then we'll talk about training and stuff after.
Sure. Well, here's the unfortunate circumstance. It's a helical angle, right? Helical being spiral. But you throw the word angle in there, and then everybody starts to think about like flat plane measurements and stuff like that. And then they try to say, well, what is the optimal helical angle? And there isn't one. There could be, if we could shape change into any shape, there would be from a movement perspective, but you would suck at everything. Like you would be incredibly average. So we don't really want that. Like the superpowers fall towards the directions of extremes, which is why we mentioned before the Olympic athletes being selected by physical structure as to what, like you look at swimmers, like all the Olympic swimmers look exactly the same. For a reason, because that predisposes them to being good swimmers. So structurally, when we think about measurement, we want to look at this not so much as an angle. It's like people throwing goniometers onto people's rib cages to try to say, oh, you're narrow or you're wide. That's horse hockey. Doesn't really help you too much. What we want to look at is the behavior. We have two. We have an inhalation, we have an exhalation representation of how the rib cage would move. And so the ribs move into ERs and IRs. And so then the infrasternal angle follows into ERs or IRs. And so when we look at the structural bias, so let's use a wide ISA as structural bias. So their bias is expansion away from the long axis, which is actually ER, right? So what we see in that circumstance is a bias towards external rotation of the infrasternal angle, which means that it moves up and away. So it expands outward and away from the long axis. And so because of their structural representation, their breathing bias, and then their movement bias, that ISA is always going to be biased towards that ER movement away from midline, even though they can squeeze it in to access space. Their tendency would be that it doesn't IR nearly as much as, say, the opposing archetype, which would be biased towards compressing towards the long axis. So when we're looking at the ISA behavior, your wide ISA tendency would be somebody that cannot move far enough into the IR'd position from their structural bias. So the structural bias is expansion away from midline. That's why they have to exhale all the time, but they can't exhale further to sort of close the ISA, if you will, into internal rotation. Okay. So that becomes their challenge. And so when you have somebody that is biased towards away from midline, in that circumstance, they're going to be a wide ISA because that is their helical archetype. the narrow ISA has the opposing representation where, because they can compress themselves so well towards the long axis, they are biased towards the internally rotated representation, the exhaled representation of their structure, and they have difficulty expanding away, even though they have to use inhalation to create space. They're not great at it by structure, and so then they have a tendency to have difficulty expanding the ISA away from the long axis. So that distinguishes the two. So the wides are wide, can't get narrow. The narrows are narrow, can't get wide.
On the UHP network, which we didn't plug in the last episode, shame on us, but Bill came out with an article that was about how to utilize and use the ISA. And in that article, there are a couple of videos of you measuring it, talking about how to measure it and showing the examples of what you were just explaining. So by the time this episode comes out, actually, that article will be posted for free in the free area, because this will probably come out around the time that we do like the quarterly free week on the network. Mm-hmm. So you can head over there, http://UHP.network, and you'll be able to see the videos of Bill explaining. And we'll talk a little bit about it here, but you'll see a little more of an explained, an actual video of you showing you doing this.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier to see it on video.
Let's go back to the basics of when I'm measuring, when you have your hands on a narrow infrasternal angle, what are you looking to see? What are your expectations to see as they breathe?
Well, what is my expectation?
Just really simply put, what's my expectation?
So I will hold my hands up like an ISA, right? So if you look at my thumbs, right? So that would be the triangular representation, and this would be like the rib cage kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So you're actually kind of like, you can actually lay your hands on somebody in that position. So but those would be there just listening, stick the ends of your thumbs together and make an inverted V with your thumbs. And there you go. And so you would basically align your hands with that, and then they go through a breathing cycle with the extremities at the transition of an inhalation and exhalation. So there is a position where you move your arms and the whole body starts to move, and that would be the transition point. And again, I would suggest you watch the videos to identify that if you haven't seen them before. But the point being is like, so if you're on somebody that you suspect to be a narrow helical archetype, when they take a breath in, you will not recognize a significant degree of external rotation, which would be an expansion away from the long axis. So what would happen is, if you had your hands on the ISA, your actually hands would move up and away from them and move apart, right? Because that would be external rotation. So they can't do that as well. So you would expect to see a deficit in that movement, because they're going to start from their structural position, right?
So what does happen then when you lay hands on a narrow infrasternal angle? What does typically happen?
They take a breath in and it doesn't move very much at all.
So where do you see the expansion happening typically?
It would be between your hands, but again, it is not a significant degree of expansion away from the long axis.
Is it more? So are you going to see more of a your hands just moving, but the angle of the ribs isn't changing at all?
Correct.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I wanted you to get to. What ends up happening? Because I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes from, and people don't know what the different, it's not really nuance, but it's more like what I want to try to give people the expectations for the archetypes as they're measuring, just to provide some clarity. So now let's do the same thing with the wide. You're laying your hands, you make the inverted V, you're laying the thumbs in that inverted V on the infrasternal angle for a wide. Mm-hmm. What are my expectations of what's going to happen and what typically happens with a wide?
Well, the best way to understand this is to have laid hands, if that's within your scope, is to lay hands on one or the other, right? And and have a frame of reference to start with, right? So tall, slender, thinking gonna be its narrow ISA, and then the short, stocky is going to be your wide, right? And so you can immediately get a representation of like where your hands actually rest. So with the wide ISA, because their radial axis is longer and they're expanded away from midline, you're going to start in a more externally rotated position. So your hands are actually further apart. And so an exhalation, and you can do this with a forced exhalation. I don't recommend this because it's going to screw up your measure because it'll be inaccurate. But you can do it with a forced exhalation. You can actually see the rib cage move under that circumstance. Not really what we're going for, but you will see that they can compress the rib cage towards the long axis, so it's towards a midline. So it would be an internally rotated position of the rib cage that they cannot produce. So the ribs tend to stay, say, in their position away from the long axis, up and away into the eared position. So where your thumbs look really close together on the narrow, your thumbs look really far apart on the wide.
Okay, and then as they're breathing, how are my hands moving with on a wide versus the narrow again?
They won't get, your hands will not get closer together, generally speaking. Yes. Yeah.
And if I was, okay. So if I am to restore relative motion, movement variability to each one of these people, I would then get to see this sort of ER and IR as I'm measuring.
Yes. So if you did a comparative measure, so let's talk through a process first. So let's just say that I'm making an assumption that I have a narrow helical archetype in front of me based on the way that my ISA measurement goes. I do an intervention that should improve their capacity for relative movement, which means that I have improved their, against their structural bias of squeezing themselves towards long axis, I've improved their ability to expand. What I should see then is a larger excursion of the ISA movement, right? Because that's one of my tells. It's like, oh, so if for them to gain motion away from this long axis, they have to be able to breathe in more. And so that's exactly what happens when you make a comparative measure, when you've gained access to relative motion, because that's the only place that they can go to get it, is they have to be able to breathe in more.
Okay. Even with, I think a confusing point might be that initially what you were talking about was the narrowest of narrows and the widest of wides who you are probably seeing in treatment who don't have the ability to move anymore. So you're laying hands on an angle that isn't going to move for both representations. When correct. when I have someone that's not going to be coming into PT anyway, so it's kind of difficult. You're not going to get your hands, if you're a clinician, you're not going to get your hands on a lot of, well, people with relative motion because they're not coming to see you.
You get biased pretty quickly as to your population.
Yeah, so that's, I think that's a huge point of confusion for people, is because they're already looking at someone who is well down the compensatory path, who is already compensating for all of these different things. They don't have this movement variability. They don't have this breathing variability anymore. They don't have the relative motions available anymore. But basically what you're saying is that someone with relative motions in normal circumstances, if they're narrow, they're always going to be on the narrower side, and they're going to have this ER and IR in this narrow space. The wides are going to be on the wider side. They're going to have this ER and IR in the wider space. No interventions in the world are going to create a 90 degree infrasternal angle for both. That's this normal average. You're not trying to do that. You're not trying to take a narrow person and make them 90 degrees. There's no neutral middle ground that we're trying to approximate.
Yeah.
They will always live within their...
We're trying to improve their capacity. We're trying to improve their capacity to overcome the structural bias.
Right, right. Okay. Right. Yeah, I just wanted to make that...
We're not trying to produce average anything. Ever.
Ever. It has to be idiosyncratic. It has to be based on the person's archetypes.
Yes.
And it has to be within their capabilities based on their structure.
Yes.
So
you
now
have to choose what you want to be.
Real quick and dirty, we talked about what happens at the ISA, what to expect at the ISA. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what am I going to see from the other classic traditional table measurements for narrows and wides? Really quick.
Well, so your inhalation bias of a narrow is going to skew you in the direction of having larger external rotation measures relative to the internal rotation measures. So if you take the textbook averages. Again, our average doesn't really exist. And so, again, if we're measuring the extremes, because we need the extremes so we can have an understanding, your most extreme narrows will be biased towards external rotation. So let's just say that we said that the average hip external rotation measure is 60 degrees. We might have somebody that would be biased to a greater degree, like 65, 70 degrees might be their idiosyncratic measurement. In doing so, though, because we're biased towards external rotation, we would see a reduction in the internal rotation measures. Right now, we would still have a full joint excursion for their structure, but their idiosyncratic internal rotation would be less.
Yeah.
If we look at the opposing, we're going to go in the other direction. So if our textbook average of external rotation for the hip in an average person is 60 degrees, then we're going to be looking at a structural bias in the wide ISA because they're biased towards internal rotation. We're going to see a reduction in that. So maybe 50, 55 degrees might be that their idiosyncratic norm, if you will. I hesitate to use the word normal because, again, what is normal for everybody? That's going to be their standard for external rotation. So again, we just see simple biases in that direction.
Right. I need to rehash this. In normal circumstances, in the people that the physical therapists and the chiropractors and their athletic trainers that are listening, these aren't the people you see. This is the point you get your patients and clients to. This is where you try to reach this point. Yes. Where they have this. It's just when you've restored relative motion, your expectations are going to be your narrows are going to have more of a bias towards ER, and your wides are going to have more bias towards IR. That's because there are going to be people listening to this that go, well, you know, all the narrows that I see have more IR than ER and have very little ER on the left. And it's like, oh, yeah, because you're talking about someone that's pushed all the way forwards and shifted to the right.
All you're seeing is the compensatory strategies applied to a structural bias. That's what we see initially, right? And we will compare to textbook averages so we can actually determine, is like, am I moving this person in the appropriate direction for their idiosyncratic structure?
Yeah. And there are tendencies based on the compensatory sequences. There are tendencies that you'll see in table measures for each, but that is that is a 4-hour conversation that we cover in courses that Bill teaches on the network.
Yeah.
Not to be done in 30 minutes on a podcast talking about. So we've got our breathing strategies, how to measure the expectations for measurement of breathing on a table. We've got the other table measure expectations for narrows and wides. If we've identified what to, we've identified the archetype for the individual that we're working with. What are some starting points and choices that we have to make when it comes to interventions and exercise?
So this is going to be somewhat dependent on what your findings will be. But if you think about if I continue to move towards the compensatory bias that's associated with my breathing strategy. So let's
talk about it from the perspective of I've restored. So this is for a different place. This is, we get into very much detail about this on the network and in the courses on the network. But if I have a narrow with relative motions and I have a wide with relative motions, what are the ways to keep them out of their own way when it comes to training? What are the choices they're going to need to make to retain their capabilities?
So are you talking about like taking a narrow and training them in higher force conditions?
Yeah. What are the things that you like, what do you want to do as a narrow? What's your wheelhouse when you're training? What things are there not going to be the same negative secondary consequences that there would be?
They're going to be lousy deadlifters.
Yeah. Right.
Right. So, and again, if you want to take away, if you want to take away a narrow helical archetype's movement capabilities, train them on very, very heavy deadlifts, like all the time. That would be like a worst case scenario, because the amount of, think about exhalation strategy, greater compression moves them towards the long axis of their physical structure. That increases the compression. You're going to take away relative motions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and again, it doesn't mean that they can't be stronger. It doesn't mean they can't produce higher forces. It just means that there's consequences to the actions, right? And so we have to be wary of such things, right? And so anything that you do that starts to bias people towards their foundational structure, If relative motion is the goal, if we had, to be very clear on that, it's like, because people want to do cool stuff like run fast and jump high and lift heavy things. It's like, yeah, there's compromises.
This conversation is about minimizing negative secondary consequences.
Right.
And I think that's why people pursue this information and knowledge, mm-hmm. because they want to avoid.
Yeah.
Because they're training themselves. They're figuring out ways to train, and they're trying not to mess themselves up because they probably messed themselves up in the past. So what you're saying is, because of the structural archetype of a narrow, we didn't get into specifics on like connotation, nutation, but the just having relative to the long axis that you're talking about, like deadlifting and typical hinging is not going to be in there.
Well, they're not good at it because they don't have access. They don't have access to the shapes, right? So again, it's like people say, well, why do I have such difficulty coaching certain people in Romanian deadlifts or deadlifts? It's like, well, because structurally they're not well designed to produce those positions or movements.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's like, well, why can't I get Joe Bob to turn? Well, because Joe Bob is a wide ISA. He is designed for less turning capabilities. Right. And higher force production.
Right.
Yeah. The concern that you run into there is if I increase a wide ISA's force production to such a great, you know, a high level, they have to create larger compensations into external rotation. Right. And in that sense, you're going to take away movement capabilities again.
Yeah.
Right. And so again, it's like driving people harder and harder in a specific direction, we just have to recognize that there are consequences that are associated with it, right? I'm already a good force producer by design. I increase my force production, great, high performance in that realm. But what are you going to be sacrificing? It's like, well, I'm going to lose more and more of my external rotation capabilities. And so then I'll have to compensate more and more in that respect. And again, you just start expanding away from midline. Again, you're following the structure and then you're going to lose more motion.
Yeah. And then same thing actually becomes true the more and more I compress and narrow from front to back with exercise as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you just look at there is compression and expansion in both archetypes. You just have to recognize the fact that one is compressing towards the long axis and expanding along that axis. The other is expanding away from the long axis and compressing on the vertical axis in that respect. And so there's losses in both the directions. We just have to recognize the fact when we move too far in one direction, if maintaining the capacity to move is the goal.
Yeah.
Okay. If you don't care about movement, to your heart's content.
Right. And
push,
you know,
push the long axis or expand them away. They'll do amazing things in some circumstances, but again, you're going to suffer the consequences.
Yeah. And you may be thinking that this is too brief of an explanation, but we have very specific episodes where we talked about training narrows and training wide. So please refer to those and you'll get more into what we're talking about there. But we wanted to accomplish a basic guide to what the ISA is, infrasternal angle, what types there are, where it comes from, and how to manage each one in a training and measurement sense. So I think we did that. What could we talk about? Okay. When you learn to drive, what car did you learn to drive
in? Oh, God.
This is a good one.
Oh, okay. Back in the old days, station wagon, fake wood paneling on the side. So
I don't think they make station wagons anymore.
I don't think so either, for good reason. They're now SUVs, right? They turn into SUVs.
The closest thing you got to like a Subaru Forester or something like that.
So this was my dad drove a four-door Pontiac Catalina, and then my mom drove the station wagon because she's a mom, and that's what you do. So you had to cart everybody around, like she was the bus driver. Kind of.
We had minivans and station wagons for that.
See, I missed out on the minivan era because I was before that. I was much before that. Yeah, station wagon, gigantic. But see, learning to drive that boat.
You can parallel park a station wagon. You can parallel park anything.
Yeah, exactly. Because you have no idea where the back end is.
Oh, yeah. It's just
huge. But cars were made out of metal back then. And, you know, if you had an accident in that baby, nothing would happen.
Yeah, you were good.
It was pretty solid. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was either a Ford Taurus station wagon or it was a Mercury Sable station wagon, which is like the same exact. Nice. Because we had a lot of those. My dad used to get, he had like a, his company had a deal with Ford. So they would get company cars back when that was a thing.
My dad drove a Taurus as well. Yeah.
So we all got handed down Tauruses basically. And I got the Mercury Sable wagon, which was like a bear to park because that thing had a huge rear end.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
It should be a requirement. It should be a requirement. You learn to drive in a station wagon.
You should have to learn to drive a bus too, just so you understand the space you take up on the road. Okay. So yeah, post in the comments what your first car, what you learned to drive in was. That's a fun thing to remember.
That's awesome. That was great. All right.
Yeah. We'll see you next time.